Can you believe we have reached episode 70 of A Journey Through Stock Aitken Waterman, Matthew Denby? And not only that, but this episode will coincide with our third birthday on May 3. Milestones everywhere you turn.
Happy birthday, Gavin. I can't believe it's been 3 whole years since we kicked off the journey, and a lot has changed since then, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And now we can almost see the finish line. Yes, we're in the home stretch, but before we get there, we've got some great music and fascinating pop culture history to cover.
We sure do. Now, it seems only fitting that this landmark episode celebrates a significant single in the Saw discography and not, you know, some dreary ballad remake. Not only is it one of the trio's best songs and biggest hits in the US, but it's also the final single released with a production credit for all three of Stock, Aitken and Waterman together. Even though we discussed Matt Aitken's departure from PWL last episode, the song we're going to talk about this time is one he worked on in late 1990, and it was finally released in mid-1991.
Yeah, this track stands out head and shoulders above a lot of the Hit Factory's later output, and it's testament to the fact that a truly great record can make it in the end, even if there's a whole lot of trouble standing in its way. Of course, I'm talking about That's What Love Can Do by American girl group Boy Crazy. Let's have a listen.
That's What Love Can Do by Boy Crazy, PWL's latest joint venture girl group with Polydor Records. Unlike Delage, the other girl group released through that arrangement, Boy Crazy had been assembled in the US before contact was made with PWL.
Boy Crazy was the product of an American management team who had a dream of creating a female version of New Kids on the Block. So, a group where every girl got a voice and was given time to shine on their own. After a long and torturous audition process that saw girls come and go, the final five of Jonna, Jocelyn, Kimberly, Renee and Ruthann were introduced to the world on their debut single.
Yeah, I've heard other names mentioned like Lauren and Jamie, but it's unclear exactly how many other singers were at one point part of Boy Crazy and at exactly what stage. Suffice it to say, any additional members aren't crucial to the story we're telling.
What we do know is that Kimberly and Jonna were there from the very start.
Yep, so let's hear about how the Boy Crazy story began from Kimberly, who'd been performing since the age of 3, moved to New York at age 16, had spent a couple of years in Starlight Express on Broadway, and had started to discuss the idea of moving into a career as a singer with her agent. Kimberly can take it from here.
I got a message on my voicemail that said, you know, hey, Kimberly, I know you're super busy. This is a last minute thing. There's an audition tomorrow morning. You need an up-tempo and a ballad, like pop song, something popular right now. And if you make it, great, you're on the list. If not, I know it's last minute. Don't worry about it. And so I was, you know, gosh, in my late teens at that point, maybe 20, and was out very late that night. And thought, well, if I wake up in time, I'll go. And if I don't, it's no, she said, it's not that big of a deal. And so I woke up and I thought, well, let me just go. It was like at 10 a.m. Like, who's singing pop music at 10 a.m.? Me. So I was like, let's go do it. And I remember I sang, my ballad was the song Alone by Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And my up-tempo was Pink Cadillac. And I danced a little. And after I finished, they asked me a couple of personal questions about what I like to do in my spare time and this and that. And then they said, well, before we go any further, you're hired and you're the first one hired and we're going to hire some of the girls. And this is what it's all about. And if you want the job, it's yours. And I, of course, was like, of course I want the job. So it was pretty quick.
So this was what, 1989?
Yes. Yeah.
So you made the group. Was there a name? Was it called Boy Crazy at that point or did that come later?
You know, I think it was always called Boy Crazy and Crazy with a K and we just accepted it and I took it on like any job. I never really at that point didn't really feel like I had any control over anything. I just showed up. I did what they wanted me to do. We immediately started working on putting a demo tape together. There wasn't a record deal. It was just this management company's idea of putting together a manufactured girl group I just looked at it like any other job. I'm being hired to be this girl in a girl group, and I need to behave that way and perform that way. And that's kind of was my mindset going into it. It then took a couple of years to really get it together with the demo. And at that point, we had done a few photo shoots, and we'd been together so long that we started having opinions and things and, you know, gelling together as a group and starting to, and not really a pushback, but have ideas about what we wanted to wear and the kinds of things we wanted to sing and what we wanted to look like and that kind of stuff. It sort of, that's the part that happened a bit organically leading up to signing the record deal with PWL.
And what were the demos? What style were the demos? Just pop, or did you try a few different styles?
It ran the gamut. I mean, at the time, musically, pop was fashionable, but it was also starting to creep into the bit of the funky R&B side as well. And so the songs were sort of this very 80s blend of pop with a little bit of funkiness. But we always were more comfortable with the pop side of things, at least for me. I love pop music. I've always been a huge fan of pop music. The more bubblegum, the better in my eyes. I just love it. I still do.
Now, we haven't been able to get a hold of Johnny yet, but someone who has spoken to her relatively recently is Mario from Cheer Up. Matt, how much fun do those Cheer Up parties look?
Bring them to Australia, Mario, please. And thank you for allowing us to play some of your interview with Jonna. Listeners, you can hear the whole thing on Cheer Up's Mixcloud. But for now, let's hear Jonna's memories of joining Boy Crazy.
I was auditioning quite regularly. I had a manager and an agent, and there was a call for female singers, and it was a takeoff. It was to be a takeoff on New Kids on the Block, but with girls. I was very not interested in doing that. I wanted to be an actress, but I had to go to this audition because my manager booked me, and I went and I sang, and she stopped me on my way out, and we sat and we talked, and then she called me about a week later, and she asked me to be in the group. And I was very intimidated by Kimberly. Kimberly has an amazing voice. It's a different octave than mine, and she can really belt it out. I was always just very, very, you know, like, she's the greatest. I'm just going to play the tambourine.
Original members Kimberly and Jonna were eventually joined by Ruth Ann, who was spotted on TV show Star Search. Remember that? I do. And Renee, whose background was on Broadway. After being shopped around to labels, the group attracted the attention of PWL America, even though that branch of the company were more into hip-hop at the time than they were pop. The girls were then shipped off for an audience at the Hit Factory in London. Let's hear Kimberly talk about that whole experience.
We were thrilled that it was all finally moving forward after such a slow process in getting started. But looking back, it wasn't slow at all. I mean, it's not shocking that it would take a year or so to get a record deal. I mean, it's not the kind of thing you just pick up at a shop. So it was very exciting looking back. It was the first time that I had ever been out of the country. And we met everyone on the team there. And I remember distinctly that the most surprising bit of it was that we stayed in a hotel, but we didn't each have a hotel room. Like, we shared hotel rooms. And I had never shared a hotel room with any of the girls, or we had never done anything like that before. And so it not only was the meeting with PWL and starting that relationship and getting to know them, but that was the first time that us as the girls of Boy Crazy really started to get to know each other on a personal level, because before that, it was just showing up for work to sing or do a dance rehearsal or whatever it was. And it was very much like a job. And then all of a sudden, there was this personal component that started where we actually needed to start becoming real friends. And that was a new aspect. And it was challenging like anything. I mean, we weren't a group. We were friends, but we didn't choose each other. You know, that was chosen for us. And so we had to learn to get along with each other. And there were challenges with that, like anything else.
And how familiar, like, did you know who PWL were? I know I've heard that you're a bit of a Dead or Alive fan, but did you connect the dots of PWL and Stock Aitken and Waterman and Rick Astley and Bananarama? Like, had you connected those dots?
No, not at the time. And when we got there and I saw the records on the wall, it started to all get very real and very exciting, like even more exciting than I was already very excited. But, you know, they had said, you know, Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan. And we were like, I knew the name Kylie Minogue, but I had no idea who Jason Donovan was. And then Rick Astley, I remembered. I recognized right away, of course. And they had just finished, I believe, doing Donna Summer's record. So then I started to understand who Stock Aitken Waterman was, the contribution they had made to pop music, which was far beyond anything I had ever thought of when we first got on the plane to go. But the more time you spent there, the more it sort of unraveled itself every day. Every time we met with someone, it was sort of getting to be a bigger and bigger deal. Mm-hmm. And that was not, I don't think, what I expected going into it. At the time, you couldn't just Google them.
Did you get a vibe at the audition that they were keen, or did they kind of play their cards close to their chest?
Yeah, I think they definitely expressed how much they liked the demo. And it was clear that they liked the way that we looked. But it was also very clear from the beginning that they had a really specific idea of what was going to happen moving forward. And for someone like myself, as a performer, I was 100% comfortable with this because I have been a performer my whole life. I've always been told what to sing, what to wear, how to move, what dance to do. And that works really well for me. I take direction really well and I can be that chameleon to be whatever it is you need. And so I was always really excited about this idea.
Kimberly also told me that first meeting was as much about the group and the US management auditioning PWL as it was PWL determining if they wanted to sign the group. I guess both sides were sussing each other out. Let's hear a bit more from Cheer Up's interview with Jonna about that initial meeting at PWL.
We weren't really getting any activity, and then all of a sudden we were on a plane and we were flying to London to meet with Stock Aitken and Waterman. And we went downstairs into this area, which was sort of like I don't know what they did down there. They didn't record anything, but there were lights and all of the effects and a big sound system, and we performed for them. We danced and we performed and they liked it and we left. We went home. And then the next thing you knew, we had an offer from them to be signed. I don't remember spending a lot of time with Mike or Matt. I believe Pete kind of came in and maybe had some of his people come down. David was a huge, it was all about David. David was running the place, so he was in charge. And we didn't really get to interact with them at that meeting, but they did sign us after that audition.
According to Mike Stock, in an interview he did with Dance Music Authority magazine back in the mid-90s, the band's early days at the Hit Factory were not without drama, although he says he and Matt were not instigators in that. Quote, "Matt and I have never fallen out with any of the acts we've worked with. Before we'd even recorded one single note with them, the lead singer was sacked because she refused to get her hair cut for the photos for the sleeve. We hadn't even made the record yet. She had really long red hair and they wanted her to cut it back, and she refused because she'd been growing it all her life. That's the sort of stuff that was happening outside of our control, and that was affecting our destiny. Boy Crazy, along with Delage, were part of a sort of engagement with Polydor, which was again a commitment to give them so much product. In retrospect, it was the first move away from PWL being independent."
It's worth noting that Kimberly does not recall this happening at all. And besides, there was never meant to be a lead singer as such in the group. But that story about someone being kicked out over a haircut persists to this day, and I kind of love it. What we do know is that the group did drop down to four members and there was now a vacancy in the Boy Crazy lineup. Enter Jocelyn, who is going to tell us how she became involved and provide some more info about what the concept for the group was. So you were lucky last.
Yeah.
And what was that like, slotting into that? Were you fine to...
Yeah, they weren't like friends or anything, so they were kind of put together and then I just came in. So it was great. You know, we all became friends.
Were you doing lots of auditions and things like that? Was this something that you were doing on the scene in New York?
No, not at all. In fact, I was running a company. I was producing commercials and television shows, and I had always had a dream to be a singer. And, you know, when I was about 5 years old, I asked my father why he stopped painting. And he said, well, you don't do your art as your career. So I decided in the infinite wisdom of five that you don't do your art as your career. And I didn't really pursue it. And I always sang on the side and sort of, you know, did cabaret shows here and there. But then I was about 3 months before I got the Boy Crazy gig, I was in a transformative seminar and I saw that that was a decision I made at five and not the truth. So that sort of released me from that kind of prison of that truth. And I started to introduce myself to people as a singer, which initially felt like a lie because I didn't have any evidence for it, right? I was like, I'm a singer kind of in my shower or whatever. But then I started, you know, scheduling shows and doing my demo. And within those 3 months, my girlfriend, who I had said I was a singer to, she auditioned for Boy Crazy. And she really wasn't a singer. She was more a dancer. And she said to them, you know, I'm not right for this, but my friend Jocelyn is a singer. And I get this phone call from the manager and she's like, we hear you're a singer. I was like, who, what? What are you talking about? What, who are you? The one of the people that I said that to in the last 3 months? And that was that.
And what do you recall about the audition? I mean, did you have a formal audition?
Nope. I went and I met with the managers and the record company executives and I had my demo. So I gave them the tape. You know, that had three songs that I was singing. So it showed that I could sing. And we just had a conversation. So there was no, you know, choreography or, you know, sing this song or anything like that. It was more of a personality audition, I'd say.
So you came in and were pretty much flown straight to London.
Basically, yeah. Not a bad gig.
Not a bad gig. I mean, did that make going into it a lot more, you know, this is established, they've got a deal, this is going to happen. Did it reassure you that this wasn't just something where you'd be sitting around waiting?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely like a real thing. It was a real record deal. It wasn't like, let's try and get a record deal. It was like, nope, we have a deal and we're looking for a fifth person. And it was between me and this young, like 13 or 14 year old girl. And originally, after I met with the executives and the managers, they called me the next day and said, well, we decided to go with the young girl because we want to keep it really young. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I was like, all right, well, this obviously it's possible to do this. It doesn't have to be so hard. So I started making a list of who else did I know in the music industry that I could then get my demo to. And the next day they called me and said, we changed our mind. We want you. I was like, okay. You know, so it was kind of an interesting little process.
And I mean, there were quite a few girl groups around at the time in the US, but I guess more from the dance and freestyle scene. There was Exposé and Cover Girls and Seduction and Sweet Sensation. And so what were you told about the project? That, in my understanding, it was going to be more pop and mainstream than any of those groups I've mentioned.
Yeah, I was told it was the female version of New Kids on the Block. That was the pitch line.
So going for more of a mass market audience.
Yeah, I guess so. Or younger. I think, you know, the Ruth Ann was something like 14 when we started, or 13. So she was so young. And I was the oldest one in the group in my early 20s. So the, you know, the rest of them were all teenagers.
And I mean, these days, it's quite unusual for a girl group to have the word boy. Did anyone think it was odd to have the word boy in the name of a girl group?
Nobody ever told me that, because the context really was being Boy Crazy, which is all about girls. So I, you know, or I guess if you're a boy, you could be Boy Crazy. But for sure, at that time, that's how we identified it. I always used to say, though, because I was the older one, I would say, they're Boy Crazy, I'm man hungry. So that was, you know, in all our radio interviews.
And so in late 1990, Boy Crazy headed back to PWL to begin recording. And the first track they worked on was the song that would become their debut single.
But That's What Love Can Do originally sounded quite different to the released version. That's what Love Can Do initially sounded like. But after it was briefly considered as a vehicle for Samantha Fox, which is something we discussed with her back in episode 42, That's What Love Can Do was picked as Boy Crazy's first single. and given a refresh for the occasion.
Let's hear a bit more of the 1991 single version of That's What Love Can Do, followed by the soul disco classic that's said to have inspired the new mix.
Yes, Best of My Love by Emotions from 1977. And I never picked up on that being the plot track at the time. Actually, in 1991, I'm not actually convinced I knew what a plot track was, but it couldn't be clearer now that the Emotions probably influenced the final mix of That's What Love Can Do.
Another point that is often discussed about this song's history is the often repeated rumour that it, along with a bunch of other boy crazy tracks, was originally intended for Kylie Minogue. That suggestion was given a boost by Pete Waterman, who told interviewer Paul Smith, quote, "The tracks were brilliant. They were really Kylie tracks." Now, whether he meant that literally or just figuratively, we don't know. But a few odd recycled tracks aside, Saw didn't tend to repurpose vast swathes of material from album projects. And we do know for sure that some of the tracks on the Boy Crazy album were written specifically for the girls. More on that very soon.
For now, let's hear Kimberly, then Jonna, and then Jocelyn talk about That's What Love Can Do coming together and how it was decided who would sing what on the song.
I could be wrong, but I think That's What Love Can Do was the very first song we worked on with them. And the thing is that having never worked as a recording artist before, I had no idea how this process went. And so I was just sort of waiting to be told how it was all going to work. We were coming in to record. I knew we were coming in to record. And I had no information about what we were singing. I didn't know the words. I didn't know the name. There was nothing. It was just like, come to the studio tomorrow at, 11 o'clock and we'll start. And I thought to myself, how are we going to start? Like, I don't even know the song. I haven't even had time to practice, right? Normally, I would sing it 3 million times in my bedroom before I went into a recording studio. But that's not how that process was working at the time. And they played the music for us, and we got excited. And they told us the name of the song. And Mike would sort of sing it a little bit. And then we would go line by line, and he would give us the notes and the words line by line, and we would sing one line until it was perfect. That was how we recorded the first song. And that's really how we recorded all of them.
Right, right. Was that together or individually?
We were all there.
Okay.
And in the beginning, we were all singing lead on the song. Like, everybody was getting a chance to sing the song. And then at some point during the first few days, you know, just the way that the key that the song was in, the notes of the song, that particular song seemed to suit Jonna's voice for lead vocals the best. And the harmonies during the verses and things seemed to suit my voice the best. And we worked really well together. Jonna and I sounded really well together. It was easy for us to sing together, and the sound of our voices really complemented each other. And I know that, or I think that Mike and Matt really liked that sound of the two of us. And so that was when the harmony on the second verse came, and we sort of sang the lead, you know, they play with vocals in a really interesting way there. When you're singing into the magic microphone, of course, everybody's singing one at a time in the studio, and then they go back and they sort of play with the levels. And in moments, I'm not even sure if it's me or Jonna, or, you know, there's once in a while, it's like, well, so-and-so singing lead on this, and all of a sudden the chorus will come up and I'm like, hey, that's my voice. You know, like, your voice pops up in really unexpected places where you weren't sure that was going to happen. And so although we have, I guess technically lead vocals are different depending on the song, in a way, all the songs are a compilation of all of our voices together in some mix and match version, depending on what sounded best for that song. And that was a whole new process. I had never experienced anything like that. And I thought it was very cool.
And was that discussed with you that we're going to share leads around and we're going to do this? Or did they just do what they did and you were presented with, here's the track?
Well, we were always, from the very beginning, even the demos were shared lead vocals. There was never meant to be a lead singer. It was always just depending on the song,
okay,
you know, whose voice did it suit the best? And that's how we approached the album as well.
So the task for Mike and Matt was to craft songs that would work for different people.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know, you know, I'm 100% sure that there were many things discussed about Boy Crazy when we weren't there that we were not privy to. You know, they've got a plan for everything and they let you know what you need to know on a need to know basis when you need to know it. And that's kind of how they dole out the information. And being, you know, a young 20-year-old artist, I was just, I would have sold my soul to the devil for this. And a lot of people think sometimes that, you know, that's exactly what record deals can be. But for me, I was just happy to be there. I mean, I was happy. If that was the devil, then bring it on, because I had a blast.
With Jonna getting the lead on the first one, did that kind of put any noses out of joint? Was there a bit of kind of, oh, or was everyone fine with it?
It's hard to know. I mean, the truth is that we were individual girls who all wanted to be in the front, but we were in a situation where we had to learn to share that spotlight. And I think that was a learning curve. I mean, there was a learning curve for me. I'm sure there was a learning curve for the rest of the girls. But when you are, it's like any group activity, you know, some days you just need to put your ego at the door and get the job done because that's what's best. And it certainly turned out to be that way for That's What Love Can Do.
Matt laid on the floor and really was not interested at all in participating or meeting us. We were loud Americans, girls giggling, and you know, so Matt was just over behind the board on the floor, and then Mike brought us in individually and had us sing for him so he could hear our range, our tone, and he talked to us and asked us questions. And I went in first because the girls were kind of intimidated and afraid. And like I said, I always thought I was going to be in the back playing the tambourine. So I really didn't care. And I thought, well, I'm going in. So I went in and we sat and we talked for a very long time. He had me sing That's What Love Can Do. And then he started recording it. And the other girls were sent back to the hotel, and I stayed for the rest of the day, which was probably anywhere from 12 to 18 hours, maybe. Not that much, but I don't know. It was long. And we recorded That's What Love Can Do. And I remember getting in the car, driving back to the hotel, and I had this overwhelming feeling of... I just really felt like I had accomplished a great thing in my life, especially as a 19-year-old girl. And to hear the song when they would play it back in the studio, and it was a great moment in my life, and I'll never forget it.
We didn't have that whole produced track to record to. We had just a rough track, and then they produced it around it. So we had nothing to do with the enhancement and the, you know, the synths and the strings and the, you know, we came in, we sang to a rough track. It was a skeleton track. And then they built around the vocals, which is what they would do with that's any recording session I've ever done. You're not recording to the finished track.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that mixing, you probably would have then been presented with what the single was and weren't aware that it went through whatever it went through.
And we had no vote. it wasn't our song. It was their song that we were singing.
And were you happy with the finished version when you heard it?
Yeah, we loved it. We loved it. They were brilliant. I mean, we would show up and they would not have written a song yet. And then they'd say, go to the pub, have a sandwich and come back. And then by the time we came back, they'd have a hit chorus written and we'd record it. I mean, they were unbelievably prolific and brilliant. It was a joy to work with them. I mean, you know, Pete wasn't really in the studio that much, but Mike Stock, to me, I just bow down and, you know, he's just a hero as far as I'm concerned. And Matt, too.
We've spoken to a lot of artists who work with them on the show. Mike is very exacting, from what I understand, with vocals and things like that. What was your experience like of working with Mike on vocals?
He's a pro. I mean, he just knows what he hears it in his head, and then you sing it until it sounds like what he hears.
Okay, so it's a bit of back and forth of no, not like that, like this.
Yeah, yeah. And he knows how to communicate to a singer, so he knows what to say to elicit the performance that he's looking for.
Because some of the older artists, more established artists, kind of found that a bit, don't tell me how to sing. It bristled a little bit, but for the five of you was a bit, you know, you would soak that up because here was someone who knew what they were doing.
Yeah, but also I was a producer. I mean, so as a producer, you have a vision and you instruct whoever it is that's performing, whether it's an actor or a singer or whatever, to do what your vision is. And I viewed them as they were the producers. They were the creator producers. We weren't going to them with songs we wrote and trying to then get that. No, it was their creation that we were performing. So as far as I'm concerned, it was our job to fulfill their vision, not their job to make our song great that we wrote.
Working with Stock, Aitken and Waterman, I think that's the best way to go into it. And
probably, yes, the path of least resistance, I would say. But there was no reason for us to put our 3 cents in. Our job was to execute the vision.
Thanks again to Mario at Cheer Up for that Jonna audio. And if you don't know what we're talking about when it comes to Cheer Up, head to Cheer Up Pop Party on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all the usual places. And you can see the fantastic parties that Mario throws in the UK. He's got a Saw 40 party coming up very soon and recently just did an anniversary gig with Hazel Dean. Anyway, back to those 1990 sessions, and also recorded at that time was the song that would become the B-side of That's What Love Can Do, Boy Crazy's version of this underrated track by Yell.
Now, if you've heard the Boy Crazy album, you know the diversity of the tracks on there. The whole concept of the band was to showcase the different vocal and stylistic strengths of the girls, and that's the brief, however thin that brief was, that Matt and Mike were given to work with. Matt recalled in an interview with the Roadblock fan newsletter, all the girls had different singing voices. One could sing rock, one could sing R&B, one could sing ballads, and so on. But no one had taken the forethought when they were putting the group together about their musical direction, and we got no guidance at all when they came over. Plus, we were primarily aiming at the American market, which was something we didn't know particularly well. So we basically found out what the girls were capable of and tried to cover all our bases. They were all good singers in their own way. One of them had a voice that was absolutely stage. It was a stage voice. She didn't sound soul or pop. So in the end, the song we wrote for her could have been out of an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, unquote. Matt talked further on this subject with Dance Music Authority, where he said of the project, there was no direction. They didn't know where they wanted to go, so we went all around the houses. We did rock tracks, R&B tracks, ballads, just to try and find something that somebody liked, unquote. Mike also seemed more than a bit exasperated with the direction they'd been given for the band, telling the same publication, somebody actually had the idea that we should do 5 sorts of records because, quote, there were 5 individuals and they're all individually talented. This was the A&R policy.
Well, despite their frustrations, they did come up with the goods, and we'll talk in more detail about the album tracks in an upcoming bonus episode. Start sending in your rankings now if you like, but it's worth mentioning a couple of them quickly. including that Andrew Lloyd Webber-style ballad, Who Could Ask for Anything More, which was a vehicle for Renee's more musical theatre performance style.
Right, well, Renee said this to Tom Parker for the liner notes on the Boy Crazy album reissue for Cherry Pop. It was an experience just to work with Saw. I remember that all the girls would sit in the side room and wait for them to call us in for the singing. We would talk to the staff, have tea, order food, all the things that girls do when recording an album. There was always this mystery with what was going to happen next, as it seemed that Mike, Matt and Pete would have to see what inspired them in the moment. I was the fresh from theatre person and hadn't recorded much prior. I remember they called me down to sing Who Could Ask for Anything More. It was such a sweet song.
It is a sweet song, and then there was something at the opposite end of the spectrum, just like a dream come true, with Ruth Ann handling the lead vocal.
Ruth Ann told Tom Parker, "When we walked into PWL the first day, I was in such awe about where I was and looking at all the gold and platinum records. I hadn't known who they were until then, when I realised that Kylie was on the same label. I just froze when we were asked who wanted to go at the first lead. As Jonna said, she jumped in and that was her song. When it was my turn, my song was Just Like a Dream Come True, and that was exactly how I felt, that I was living the dream."
In a similar vein to Just Like a Dream Come True is one of my favourites from the album, On a Wing and a Prayer, which really blasted out of the speakers until it got watered down for an alternate mix. That initial guitar-heavy version of On a Wing and a Prayer has always reminded me of this. Yes, the Beverly Hills 90210 theme, but Matt Aitken says there was a different influence.
We were kind of doing Belinda Carlisle, sort of. And I was really pleased with the finished product. Mike was really pleased with the finished product.
You know, I quite like Saw doing that American soft rock sound. Like, pretty much any genre, they could pull it off. I wouldn't have minded hearing more of that power pop rock from them with other artists, but I guess that sound often didn't fly in the UK.
Okay, well, let's go back to Kimberly to talk more about On a Wing and a Prayer.
Was that your song from the get-go? Was that kind of written with your voice in mind, do you think?
It was always mine, yeah. I think that I have to assume that they wrote it specifically for my voice, and I was always the lead on that one. There was never even, I don't even think anyone else ever sang it.
It's quite high.
Yeah.
Should have been a single.
I agree. We all thought it was going to be. We all were thinking that was going to be the second single. And I remember being a little disappointed, frankly, when it wasn't, because I really liked it. I especially am a fan of the more sort of edgy, rocky version. There's a bit of a rock guitar version of it, which I loved from day one.
Yeah.
And I was personally disappointed at the choice of Good Times with Bad Boys over Wing and a Prayer. But I figured they knew, they had a plan, and it seemed to be that as the singles were released, it became more and more clear a bit of what the vision was and what their plan for us was.
To sum up this discussion of the recording process, Jocelyn is going to talk about what it was like working with Saw as a group with five singers.
It was a challenge, I think, for them, because we all had very different styles and very different voices. We weren't like, we didn't grow up harmonizing with each other. And, you know, so it was distinct. But I think they did a really good job of finding and writing songs that worked for each person's voice. And that was not easy for them, you know, because the first song we recorded was That's What Love Can Do, which ended up being the hit. But after that, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, it'd be easier to just have Jonna sing the lead on everything. But that was not what the concept was. So it was important to everybody, obviously, because we didn't sign on to be background singers, you know. So it just happened to be that she sang that first one. You know what I mean? We all had a shot at singing it. They got us in front of the mic. Each one of us sang the hook. She sounded the best on it. It was appropriate for her to sing that song. But then when it came to other songs, I mean, like On a Wing and a Prayer, nobody could sing that song but Kimberly, you know, the way, or Love is a Freaky Thing. I was the one to sing that song. And so they worked to find the right vehicle for each voice. And I think they did a really good job. I think it was dramatic in terms of people's egos, and it got a little bit dicey from time to time. But I think in the end, they did a really good job. I'm sorry that one of the songs that actually used all of our voices, like we had nice pieces in each song, didn't make it on the album, Exception to the Rule, which I think is a good example of five people collaborating on a song and not, you know, really being left with one person's voice, which was sort of the vision of the group, but it didn't make it on the album.
If Mike Stock had have had his way, would it have been, okay, well, Jonna sung the first song, let's just stick with Jonna, and the rest of you were like, well, no.
I don't know. No, you'd have to ask Mike. But he never said that to us, like, okay, now we're just going to do that. He always was looking, okay, how do we incorporate, you know, each person? Because that was the concept, you know, of the group.
As well as recording all those tracks, it was exciting for the girls to film their first video. And I wouldn't be the last one for That's What Love Can Do. Let's hear from Kimberly now about stepping in front of the camera for the first time.
Talk to me about the music video and all that spinning.
That was crazy. That music video was the very first time I had ever done a music video. I think it was the first time any of us had ever done a music video. It was very odd because it was hard to think about what it would actually look like. There was the spinning around, there was drifting back and forth from side to side with fans, but it was hard to really know what was that going to look like because we weren't involved in any of the production or anything for that video. And we had no clue what the goal was. Once again, it was like, we're going to do a music video. We've got all your clothes and everything. So you just show up and we'll take care of the rest. And then it was sort of like, now you're going to sit by this payphone and drift back and forth while you sing. And now you're going to sit in this chair that's going to spin around while you sing. And everybody took turns at all the different stations. And then they spliced it all together. And that was the video. The thing that was disappointing for me is that there was no dancing. It left out one of the big parts of who I am as a performer and how I saw myself as a recording artist. But again, at the time, it's our very first song. It's our very first video. And we're just happy to be in the room.
Happy but dizzy, perhaps.
You know, it wasn't as spinny as it maybe looks.
As well as a video that looked pretty good, That's What Love Can Do really had everything going for it. It's a great catchy tune performed by five strong vocalists, and that old, oh, all soul songs sound the same criticism could definitely not be applied here. And yet...
Yes, because unfortunately the song bombed on its first release in the UK, hitting a shocking number 86 on the British chart. That really demonstrates just how impossible things had gotten for SOAR in the UK market by this point. Their new music was now unable to get a foot in the door, and I suspect it was being actively rejected by the gatekeepers without even giving it a fair listen. Because to me, what's very clear with this record is that it deserved to be a hit. The chart position isn't reflective of any quality issues. This is not all mixed up. This is an excellent song with great production and wonderful vocals. This wasn't a cringy act. They had talent and they had charisma, and nothing makes a Hit Factory record fly to much greater heights like an act with those characteristics. I love this single. It's one of SOAR's very best, but I didn't get to hear it until it got its big break in America a long time after its UK release. I remember I was at someone's house, they had American Top 40 on, and I heard the first notes and I thought, my God, this sounds like SOAR. And at that point in time, I hadn't heard a new SOAR record in a very, very long time, so it really confused and shocked me, and I had to go and find out what was really going on. I had to find this record.
Yeah, it was American Top 40 that introduced me to That's What Love Can Do as well, because I don't recall hearing the song in 1991, not even courtesy of my trusty UK pen pal. I think the fact that it missed the UK Top 75 meant it didn't really come on my radar at that point. But I think I prefer the structure of that first 1991 version, starting with the verse as opposed to kicking off with the chorus like in the later 1993 version. And I love the verse, the bits that start "You're Just a Fool," or the second verse "All I Can Say." And I also really love the pre-chorus, the "Look Around and You Will See," or "So Just Forget About Eternity." They're really, really strong elements of the track. And then obviously the chorus is fantastic as well. My one bugbear is I could have done without this vocal lock at the start and in the middle. Less is more.
Agreed on all, agreed on all, Gavin. I really don't think it needed that. This song is more than strong enough to stand on its own merits without those kind of gimmicks. So as we've indicated, there was a lot going on around this release. Let's hear now from Kimberly and Jocelyn to discuss the single coming out in 1991 and what happened in the UK.
It was rough. I mean, we were very excited, you know, and really liked the song. We really thought the song was great. And then as the months ticked on and it didn't get quite the reception we'd hoped for in the UK, you know, you start to doubt. You start to feel like, well, maybe I just like it because I like hearing the sound of my own voice. You know, maybe it's not a great song. But it was like, it's a Stockake and Waterman song. How can it not be a great song? So maybe the song is great. Maybe it's us. Maybe the public just, there are all these things go through your head. Right? It can't be the music because Stockake and Waterman, at that point, we were well informed of the scope of Stockake and Waterman. And so it started to feel like maybe it's because maybe we're American and maybe we don't look right. Maybe we don't sound right in the interviews. Maybe, I don't know. We had no idea. But it's also, most things in show business sometimes feel like they can be a flip of a coin anyway. But you never know. Anything can affect how it gets perceived from the public. And so going down the rabbit hole of trying to figure out why is a really daunting task. And it was a bummer, really, in the end. We were sitting back home in America, and the phone wasn't ringing. We were just sitting there, and it was like, are we going to have to, like, go get jobs? Like, what's going to happen? Like, what happens when it was our first record deal and our first single and our first music video and the first time that it had ever flopped. So we didn't know what happened after that. You know, will we ever go to London again? Will they ever speak to us again? Who knows?
We did a lot of, like, the Ghost Train TV show. We did a lot of kids shows to promote it, but it never really, I think there was like a big backlash against Stockaken and Waterman at that time, because that was around the time of Milli Vanilli, if you recall, and they were gotten so much trouble because they were lip syncing and da da da. And so they kind of assumed that Stockaken and Waterman had a bunch of, you know, girls that didn't really sing and then session singers that were singing the track, which was not the case in our case. We could sing. You know, we were like, oh, we have a record deal. Everything's going to be great, blah, blah, blah. And then we did our first live gig on a beach for like 100,000 people. And they introduced us. And it was like 100,000 people booing. And we were like, what is going on here? And, you know, then we went backstage and they were going to bring us back out to do the song. And we were like, what is going on? And they explained there was this little backlash because they, you know, the reputation and blah, blah, blah. And so at that moment, we had to, you know, decide, what are we going to do? We're going to go back and get booed, or are we going to show them we can sing? So we spent the 20 minutes backstage rehearsing a live 5-part harmony a cappella version of our chorus. And we went out, and instead of going right into our lip synced dance routine, which we were about to do, because that's what you did when you had dances, you would, of course, lip sync. We went out and sang live 5-part harmony a cappella of our hook, and then went into our lip sync dance routine. And by the end of the song, we had the 100,000 people cheering instead of booing. So, I mean, it was an interesting time. But I think, you know, what we were battling is we were Americans and they had a bad reputation at that moment. So
I think they'd been too successful in the 80s and had, you know, the 4 songs in the top 10 at once, because there were other songs by people like Sybil and Lonnie Gordon, who obviously could sing. that didn't do well because there was that resistance at that point. And I guess, did you find that with radio as well, that radio was a bit resistant in the UK?
You know, I wouldn't know about the numbers in the States. I tracked all that stuff, you know, in terms of which station was playing what and the numbers and the charts and everything. But there, we were kind of clueless, honestly. And it was just the very beginning and we kind of didn't know how anything worked. And, you know, we just followed the lead of our manager at the time who was really working for the record company. So it was a little bit of a conflict of interest. So it wasn't really like, it wasn't set up super powerfully for us. And unfortunately, with all those circumstances in terms of the lack of support for them and, you know, us kind of not knowing what we were doing. And then also the fact that we were like five American girls trying to get like bulls in a china shop coming into this whole situation. I just don't think it worked. But in the States, the song was amazing. I mean, you know, regardless. And I think without all those surrounding circumstances, it might have done better in the UK.
That's what love can do. I don't wanna break your heart in two and leave you crying. Yeah. That's what love can do. Well, no, I want you to know I'm letting you go.
So the girls thinking on their feet there really did stand them in good stead, because that a cappella performance was wheeled out a few times, including there. What we just heard was on American TV. Fantastic work. Great vocals, girls. Well, the failure of this track wasn't just hard on the band. It hit Mike and Matt pretty hard too. And for good reason. If you're making something this good and it's still not charting, it really would feel like the cards are now so impossibly stacked against you. You might want to reassess what you're doing. Matt told Roadblock there was nothing wrong with the material. It was what was happening between us doing it and the outside world getting to hear it. It all went horribly wrong on the record company side of things. They didn't break the record here. There was also all sorts of personality conflicts within the band and with the management, which wasn't a very stable environment to be working in, unquote. Recalling his decision to quit the production team, Matt added, "If the right artists don't happen, then you don't have a vehicle for what you do. And I believe that the right people didn't come along. Boy Crazy is a perfect example. We bust a gut on that album, and it was quite clear that they had no idea where they were going, and the American record company didn't either. Basically, we were producing fantastic gearboxes, wonderful tyres, marvellous steering wheels, and the best engines in the world, and nobody was actually assembling it properly and putting it on the racetrack." Added Mike Stock, "That was one of the last projects that Matt and I did, and I think it kind of broke his back."
Undeterred by all this, PWL released a second Boy Crazy single called All You Have to Do, which, of course, we'll get to in due course. We'll talk about that and the departure of Renee from the lineup in a few episodes' time. But, spoiler alert, it didn't perform so well commercially, and Boy Crazy were back in the US in the process of being dropped by PWL when something entirely unexpected happened.
Yes, by later 1992, the single had made its way onto a Hot Tracks DJ mix CD, and from there it picked up attention at a Colorado radio station. It was hugely popular with listeners, and then quickly caught fire across US radio. The track was rushed out by PWL-aligned US label Next Plateau. It then did what only 9 Saw Records had done before it, breaking into the top 20 of the Billboard Hot 100, where it peaked at 18. It got to number 1 on the US Radio and Records Pop Airplay chart and number 2 on the Billboard Top 40 Mainstream chart.
You gotta love the American music industry, a chart for literally everything. But to achieve those kind of positions on those airplay charts, you know that the song was absolutely hammered on pop radio in the US. Finally, someone saw sense. And speaking of seeing sense, it does make sense that That's What Love Can Do would appeal to US radio given its pop soul influences. Also appealing to the US market was a brand new video shot for That's What Love Can Do. It had some very American scenes in it, like the girls going into a diner, and it also had that classic music video trick of seeing them in their rehearsal gear, working on a routine, and then doing the finished thing all glammed up.
Right, well, let's hear now from two of the ladies at the Eye of the Storm, Kimberly and Jocelyn, about how the single took off in America.
there was a woman in, gosh, I want to say Colorado. She was a program director for a radio station. Her name is Stacy Cantrell. And she was out at a bar one night with some friends. And at that point, I guess what had happened is PWL had licensed the song out to some jukebox company. When jukeboxes went into bars and restaurants and things like that, they went in with all of today's hits. And then there would be this filler music that would go in. And I guess somebody had turned on the jukebox to play random music. And our record, the one song, was in that mix of however many are inside a jukebox. And it came on and she really liked it. And so when she got back to work the next day, she went searching for this record and contacted PWL and asked them for a copy. And they sent it to her. She played it on her station. And within a couple, the story that I remember her telling us is that within a couple of weeks, it was the most requested song on her station. And then it started to bleed over to all the other radio stations. And it sort of spread out through the country, starting there with her. So we are forever grateful to Stacy Cantrell. And it's a name I will never forget.
Only takes that one person.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. We got this phone call that said, did you know you're the number one record in these markets? And we were like, what do you mean? Like, we weren't even sure. We didn't even know that it was being released in the States because there was no plan. It just started being played. She basically released the song by starting to play it. And so there was a minute of catch up to put together some promotion and where were we going to go? And the craziest thing happened was there was going to be this big show at a stadium in Colorado. And they asked us if we would sing a few songs. And we were like, okay. And there were some really, really famous people playing at this show. And it was crazy to even think that we were going to be in the same building as them, let alone share a stage. We were really concerned that this no-name band, that we were just going to show up and people were going to be looking at us like, why are you here with all these famous people? There's like all these famous people and then you. Like Sir Mix-a-Lot was there with his gang of people who had like big guns and like, I don't know, Flock of Seagulls was there. Like all of these, like, bizarro mix of bands that were all over the place. I think Exposé might have been there. And we get up on stage and at the stadium, it's like 50,000 people. It's hard to explain what that looks like from the stage when you've never done that before. We start with our backs to the audience and I'm just thinking, just don't let them start throwing things. Like, we just need to get through. I think we sang like two, maybe three songs. And we started with That's What Love Can Do. And everybody's mouths were moving. And like everyone you could see knew the words. And that it was like, you know this song? Like we were shocked. I was shocked that people knew the song and they loved the song. And they were singing it right back to us. On top of us having this roller coaster of it. Good, it's not good, people like it, nobody likes it, everybody likes it. Some people, you know, like, just all kind of came together in that one moment. And for me, I just thought, well, if I never sing this song again, I can die happy. Like, this is got to be the best job I've ever had. It was pretty good.
It was only because of, you know, Denver in the U.S., a little import, you know, that happened with the radio station KS104 in Denver, and they started playing it and it just shot up. In fact, the record company dropped us. They called us and said, okay, we're going to be releasing you from your record deal like a week before it went number one in the States. So then they called us back and they were like, well, we didn't mean we were dropping you. We meant you got to come back and finish the album now because we had no records in the stores because the album was never finished. And here we are, number one, and had no records in the stores. And I honestly think that was one of the biggest reasons why we never had another real surge is because we missed that window of opportunity, you know?
It must have been fantastic that the song had connected and found its audience finally.
Yes, we were so thrilled and pleasantly surprised.
Given the US success of That's What Love Can Do, the track was re-released in the UK in March 1993 with the new US mix as the lead version and some fresh remixes done for the occasion, but those stubborn Brits resolutely refused to get behind it.
Yes, the song only got to 80, which is a real shame. It seems that the UK market was closed even after that amazing US success.
It's really disappointing that PWL just couldn't get That's What Love Can Do across the line in the UK. Jocelyn has an amusing take on it, which pretty much sums things up. That's What Love Can Do re-released in the UK, didn't do anything again, and so maybe they were just like, this isn't going to work in the UK.
I think they realized, yeah, exactly. They were like out of their, they read the room. That's what I would say, you know.
And yet, despite not reading the room properly and the previous lack of interest in the song, PWL tried one more time to make That's What Love Can Do happen in Britain with a 1999 sound-alike remake produced by Topham, Twig and Waterman for London Records all-girl trio Toutes Les Filles.
Right, well, I think the less said about that, the better.
Oh, I love that version. I bought that version when I was in the UK in 1999, and I thought, finally, this song might become a hit here. The group was kind of like an Atomic Kitten-ish style girl group, but sadly, no, that also didn't succeed. Okay, let's wrap things up and give the final word on That's What Love Can Do to Matt Aitken.
They had the legs. I didn't mean physically. Yeah, they, if management... us and whatever had really had any kind of idea what they were trying to do, I think they could have really, really done something. They had five different voices, all of which were pretty good, but they were a little bit, hey, look, we're a girl band and we've been put together as a girl band and we really are a girl band. But I think there are three or four tracks on that album that are really, really good. I think On a Wing and a Prayer was good. I think we did some really good tracks with them. And, of course, one of them went top 20 in the States. Yeah, Jonna sings that. She hates that track. She's about 50 now. She hates it. She thinks it's a piece of shit. And I just like to Zoom with her and tell her that it isn't a piece of shit. And she sang it brilliantly. And if only the transition between the verse and the chorus never worked on that. The verse is brilliant and the chorus is always a letdown. It's a really strange, we really messed up on that. But it's a great track. Every time I play it, I'm off. You know, it's got it.
And if we ever get a hold of Jonna, that's one Zoom discussion we'd love to facilitate. And Matt Aitken once again giving us our explicit rating for the episode. Well, despite the UK story, at least in the US, it was a case of all's well that ends well as far as That's What Love Can Do was concerned. We have more of the boy crazy story to tell, though. When we reach All You Have to Do, we'll talk about that second UK single, and we'll also discuss the second US single, Good Times with Bad Boys, and hear how the group ended up going their separate ways.
This story just goes to show that great songs and talent can sometimes find a way. I love the boy crazy version of this song. A great vocal can really make a track ring. Compare their version to Sam Fox's, and I think we can all agree that a powerful vocal performance can take a good song to a whole different level. I'm very happy to place this track in my personal top 20 Saw songs of all time. Well done to all concerned. Great song, great vocals.
Indeed. And the big moments keep coming in our next episode when we commence our long-awaited journey into the Let's Get To It era.
We'll also bid farewell to former Saw superstar Jason Donovan when we discuss his final PWL single, and we'll hear all about his post-PWL album All Around the World.
Kylie and Jason in the one episode, that's one to look forward to. Until then, you can check out the bonus material for this episode at chartbeats.com.au/saw. I'm going to put extended interviews with Jocelyn and Kimberly in there. We will do the Boy Crazy album rank when we get to All You Have to Do, but by all means, start sending in your rankings for the 10 tracks on the standard edition. And come and say hello to us on social media. Matthew?
Yes, please do pop by. I'm on X. I'm also on Threads. And you can also see me on YouTube.
And you can find me at chartbeats.au on Instagram and Threads and Facebook. See you all soon for the next exciting episode of A Journey Through Stock, Aitken and Waterman. Bye.
See you later, everyone.